stand beside me. We're better as a unit. Ain't enough bullets in a gun to hit us all.
What's up, everybody? Here for another episode of the Code Switch Podcast. It's your boy Trevor, Trev, and my mentor Hollywood. Hollywood, man, I got on Detroit shirt.
Okay.
So, yeah, man, yeah. So, first big weekend of college football back, and so I had to rep a little bit with my alma mater, man. So that's kind of why I got the shirt on.
Hey, what do y'all season look like this year?
Well, I'll put it to you like this. We played an FCS school in our first game. For those that don't know that, FCS is kind of like a lower tier of D1 football. And we're at kind of the low end of the FBS, which is like the bowl subdivision where they play the bowls and the playoffs and all that. And we're one of the smallest schools in the FBS. We played an FCS school in our first game. I did not watch it all the way through, so I actually don't know the outcome. But we were losing at the end of the third quarter, and I couldn't take it, so I just turned it off. How about y'all, man? How y'all looking? Oh, this Ole Miss alum right here.
Hey, look, I'm gonna lose a lot of fans on this one, but you know I don't root for Ole Miss like that, man. Like I went to the school, you know, I got my degree and I got out, man. I'm not a big college football fan though either. So there's that. The only time I really root for Ole Miss is if it's playing another team that I may be at a bar or something with, and they're talking sports and they're like, oh yeah, we play Ole Miss. I'm like, oh yeah, cool. You know. So you know,
yeah. Is,
but I am not really a huge.
Well, what about in the NFL world?
Oh, Denver Broncos, man.
How y'all looking, man? How y'all looking?
You know, I'm hoping that we look good this year. We're gonna see. It's been a rough few years, but you know, we got Bo Nix now. We got some we got some hope at quarterback now after the whole Russell Wilson disaster that was after Peyton Manning. But hey, look, we had our Super Bowl, you know, Super Bowl 50. Right. So we're gonna try to come back. We're gonna try to come back in a couple of years. So we'll see. But yeah. Oh, what about Alabama, man?
We're not gonna talk about that right here, right now. That they know what they need to do. They know what they need to do.
The once feared Alabama, right? Like,
man, I mean, and it's crazy how in such a short amount of time things go to where they are. That's how you know, in my personal opinion, the problem.
Yeah. That's so true. That's true.
I'ma leave that where it's at. One last thing, then we'll move on. For your Broncos, it could be worse. Your owner could be Jerry Jones.
That is true.
Yeah.
That's funny, man. Messy pool. I'm not even gonna get Michael into Parsons. That because it actually bothers me to understand like the way we're viewed by certain owners, probably most owners, to be honest with you. You saw what happened to Shadur and everything like that, right?
We
really want to dissect it. Right. We can dissect it.
right. That might actually be a good topic, man, for a future episode. But yeah, all right, cool. So
what Jay-Z
all
right, said,
let's pivot.
We not
from
these slaves.
Hey, I'm with you. Okay, cool. So what are we talking about in this episode? Agile, framework, or buzzword? And I'm sure most people that are watching this or listening in, you have heard that term in the workplace. What it is, what it isn't, is it making our teams better or is it making our teams more frustrated? So I think this is going to be a good episode. Hollywood and I, we've had multiple conversations about just agile in practice and just at a very foundational level. So I'm super excited to Hollywood get your thoughts on agile and just really dig into this script, man. But before we do that, you know where I have to go. For those tuning in, I love to set the foundation. I love to turn to the Bible because I feel like that's kind of the foundation just for everything in life. So I love to kind of just set stage before we really go into like agile and just talk about all of it. So the scripture that I chose for this episode is Ecclesiastes, third chapter, first through the 14th verse. So to give some context on the book of Ecclesiastes, it's basically writing about the pursuit of happiness through worldly things and how we should really just kind of turn our focus to Christ, right? So the first few verses basically talk about how there are all of these things across different seasons, right? So just to give you some examples in verse 2, it says, a time to be born, a time to die, a time to plant, and a time to pluck up that which is planted. And then it goes on like that from verses 1 through 8. And basically how that translates to Agile is plans are meant to change, right? There's a season for everything. There will be ups, there will be downs. So that, I mean, that's what plans are. Plans are things that you account for, and certainly they will change. A little later in the scripture, verses 12 and 13, the point I want to make with these verses is, how do you embrace change? So verse 12, I know that there is no good in them, but for a man to rejoice and to do good in his life. Verse 13, and also that every man should eat and drink and enjoy the good of all his labor. It is the gift of God. So when you're going through these seasons, make sure that you're rejoicing and that you're keeping God at the center. And then lastly, verse 14, I know that whatsoever God doeth, it shall be forever. Nothing can be put to it, nor anything taken from it. And God doeth it that men should fear before him. And so the one constant in all of these seasons, when plans change, is God. And it reminds me of this old spiritual hymnal, Hold to God's Unchanging Hand. And I know y'all probably sang that back when you were younger, you know, but it makes me think of Baptist, that, you brother. Know.
Y'all already know.
So when you're going through these seasons, when your plans change, embrace it, rejoice, and just hold on to God's unchanging hand. So Ecclesiastes 3rd chapter, 1st through 14th verse, I encourage everybody to go check that out, read through it, research it when you get a chance. So diving into our topic, Agile Hollywood, I'm just going to start super simple. In its simplest form, what does Agile mean to you?
Oh, to simplify it, I would say Agile means to me is being able to iterate quicker on problems that come up. So versus kind of how it was done previously before I got into the industry, right? The whole waterfall method, it was more of, hey, you have your planning up front, plan, then execute. Versus now it's, you know, plan, execute, because the plans tend, like to your point, right? Plans change.
Right. And I completely agree with what you said. And I think that's really the huge benefit of Agile, right? Being able to pivot, right? Based on like, if a requirement changes or if priorities change, right? We've both seen that a lot of times. So, I mean, that is super, super common. So Agile, I think, enables you to be able to kind of, you know, adapt.
Or should be.
So, yeah, right. And we'll go into like, kind of like, what are the, you know, when does it succeed? When does it fail? Before we go that deep, I wanted to kind of talk about the very first mention of Agile. And so for a lot of people tuning in, I'm sure y'all have heard of this, but it's called the Agile Manifesto. And it was first produced back in 2001. So I'm going to read it just so we can set the stage. We are uncovering better ways of developing software by doing it and helping others do it. Through this work, we have come to value individuals and their interactions over processes and tools, working software over comprehensive documentation, customer collaboration over contract negotiation, responding to change over following a plan. That is, while there is value in the items on the right, we value the items on the left more. So to me, I think it's always interesting when you see Agile methodologies in practice within these different companies. When you go look at the Agile Manifesto, it's so much simpler compared to what we're doing these days. And So that's why, like, it's always interesting for me to go back to the Agile Manifesto, because I'm looking at how things, all these different processes at various companies these days, and I'm like, wow, what if, you know, we built all of this around something that I think when they initially created it, maybe the intentions were not for it to get to where it is today. So how did these different methodologies get introduced within Agile? So I did some research into Scrum, and I'll read through kind of like my findings and how Scrum came about. The very first thing I'll mention is Scrum was actually introduced as a concept to the industry in the 1980s. So the funny thing about that is you had the Agile Manifesto in 2001, but then you had Scrum that was first mentioned in the 1980s, right? So it does make you wonder, like, all right, did we just take one thing and try to shoehorn it into another thing? But kind of going into the background on Scrum, it comes from the sport rugby. It's the process of restarting the game after a stoppage due to a minor infringement. The teams get into a specific formation and try to gain possession of the ball. This creates a structured way of restarting the game. In the corporate world, terminology was translated to creating a scalable, team-based approach to product development. And then businesses, as they always do, they started to hear about this term of Agile, you know, once the Agile Manifesto came along a little bit further down the road. But to them, it was very abstract, right? It was like, okay, we have this term Agile. We understand that we want to try to move faster and adapt, but how do we do that, right? Like, what is the process, you know? And so that's where these various frameworks took off. But my question, not only to you, Hollywood, but even to those that are listening, do we feel like it has gone overboard? Like, I can understand, like, having processes in place. I definitely don't believe in just, like, operating in the wild, wild west. But at what point do we go overboard with process and bureaucracy?
Yeah, I would say that it probably starts with the lack of trust. I think Agile requires a lot of trust within the teams, right? Because you got to kind of trust that you're first off, Agile is a lot about empowering the team. And you have to really trust that the team is doing what they say. And I think that when you come from a business standpoint, I think there's been a lack of trust, you know, no matter how that came about, but there's been a lack of trust between development and product teams. And when I say product teams, I'm kind of referring to more of the business rather than just actual product people. And I think that's where all these processes come in place. Because again, when you read it earlier, which is, what is it? Individuals and interactions over processes and tools. And, you know, we work in our fields, right, in our respective companies, and we know how many processes have been just layered and layered and layered and layered on top of each other. And it's to the point where, again, to your question, are we actually even agile at this point? Because it's just so many processes, so many gates that you had to go through to actually get something done and delivered to the customer, which contradicts what you said earlier, too, which is customer collaboration over contract negotiation, right? Like, we can't even get to customer collaboration because we have to get through all of our gates first.
Yep, that's so true, man. And I'm glad you hit on customer collaboration, because I'll take it a step further and say, is it really customer collaboration or is it customer strong-arming? You know, because I feel like over the years, it's become less about let's have a dialogue and more about the loudest person in the room wins, and we will employ, you know, product as our henchman. You know, now I think a good product individual will try to fight the fight within reason, right? It's only so much they can do, but within reason, I think a good product person would try to shield some of that, but you know, I mean, sometimes their hands are tied. Sometimes you don't have a good product person. And then it's almost like the levees breaking, right? Where now it's just this flood of chaos, you know? and it just infiltrates the team, and it just creates a bad culture overall, in my personal opinion. So cool. All right. So now that we kind of like gave a little bit of context and history on Agile and Scrum particularly, I mean, obviously for those that are listening, I'm sure a lot of y'all are familiar with other methodologies. You have Kanban, you have SAFe. I've heard of extreme programming. Holloway, I've never done extreme programming. Have you ever done extreme programming?
No, I've actually never heard of it either.
Really? What? Yes. I've definitely heard of it a few times. So it's like capital X, capital B, but I really don't know the concepts behind it. If you're watching this on YouTube, drop a comment about what extreme programming is, if you're aware of it. But anyway, so I wanted to kind of go into, when does Agile work? Have you ever worked on a team where it actually did work? And if so, how did that look for your team? Like, what was the process? And then did you follow any methodology strictly, or were you guys loose? Like what was that experience?
Yeah, I think Agile works within the team very well. I've never seen it, at least from my experience, I've never seen it not work within the team well, because what it allows you to do is the going through the process of estimating stories and identifying, you know, what work can be done and what work can't be done. You've said this before, right? It's still your quote, right? Capacity is finite, right? You have a finite metric that, hey, I know that is all the work that could potentially be delivered within this time period, 2 weeks, a month, whatever that capacity is, right? And so having kind of that as your background, you can kind of easily track, you can really easily track whether you're on track for delivering the work or you're off track from delivering the work. Sometimes you'll get ahead, sometimes you'll get behind, and then you can kind of interject yourself and either help others or have others help you, right? Like you have a good idea of what you're trying to achieve as a team, what you can achieve as a team, and where the gaps are and how you can fill them. So I think within the team, to answer your question, Agile is very successful. It's when it goes beyond it's when we start running into problems.
Well, let me ask you this. So you feel it works very well within these teams internally. Have you ever seen it work better for some experiences over others based on maybe specific things that you guys did or maybe a certain kind of way that you guys worked? Or has it all kind of been pretty consistent for you where it just always works well and it's the highs, lows, smooth the rolls?
So I think Agile has always worked well. I think the frameworks within it is when it kind of separates what works better for which team. So for example, Scrum. We talk about 2 week sprints or however many week sprints and stuff like that. I think that's really good for a team that has a good idea and good guidance on what they're trying to achieve long term and trying to deliver incremental value short term, right? Kanban, I think, is really good when you really not sure exactly what your long term vision is, but you definitely want to deliver something and there are customer problems that you're trying to solve. So with a Kanban approach, hey, you can go and pick and choose what you deem is important to work on and pull those in. And you're not really kind of relegated to a strict timeline on customer commitments, but you know that there are customer deliverables that need to be delivered. So I think the frameworks within it really become team specific and depends on kind of what exactly you need. But as far as Agile, I think Agile and the concept is really good.
Yeah. Completely agree with that. I wanted to give an example of when I just felt empowered, right? So recently I was a consultant at this one company and we're moving fast. We have all these different contracts with all these different customers. There were no EMs. There were no product people. We just had project managers. And then you had kind of like a department manager that kind of handles like all of the like managerial aspects, right? And that's not to say that they weren't technical, but you know, they were not as hands-on in the projects compared to like an EM. I will say that actually was pretty refreshing from an Agile standpoint because it really broke down all of these processes and really kind of washed them away where, hey, we're interfacing directly with the customer. You know, they have problems. We're delivering value like at lightning speed, and nobody's in the way. You know, we're not sitting in meetings. We're not having like something come out of like left field that has nothing to do with what we're focused on. We are literally talking to the customer, delivering value. We're not getting caught up in semantics of, oh, how do I write a user story? Oh, we have to have refinement on this day. You know, like we are literally just like, we're just chugging along, you know? And that was super refreshing. And the crazy part, right? For those that don't know, I'm actually back in an EM role, but it's funny for me to say that because I am an EM, but at the same time, like we should not be a bottleneck to the team delivering value, right?
Yep.
And so that's where I think like a good person that's not like one of the engineers that's day-to-day delivering, like you really have to hone in on what are your roles and responsibilities and how are you helping the team move forward. Just a little bit. Yeah. So, okay, cool. The next thing I wanted to kind of bring up is Agile supporting rapid iteration and short feedback loops. So Hollywood, how does that work for you guys when it comes to delivering value? So I agree with you that, you know, Agile works really well when it comes to like within the team internally. But when you take it kind of a level up and you say, okay, we're basically deploying or releasing to production, and we need feedback. How do you guys iterate on that and make sure that you're getting feedback fast?
Yep. Feedback from who, actually? Because I think that kind of matters, right? There's feedback from product. As developers, we are writing code. Let me hold before we get to product QA, right? We're writing code and we're deploying it to whatever environment, and we're getting quick feedback from QA. They don't have to worry about, hey, we're building all this stuff up front and then throwing it over to QA, which we talked about throwing work over in our previous episode. But and then getting it into product's hands is a lot quicker. These smaller features are smaller deliverables into product's hands quicker. Mm-hmm. Quick feedback there. So the feedback loop is really, really, really quick. And then from product to customer, obviously it's a little bit longer feedback, right? Which is, you know, your release mm-hmm. cycles and things like that. But ideally in Agile, you're releasing really, really, really frequently. So for those who are not familiar with Agile, a lot of us, I believe, are, but just in case for those who are not, ideally you're releasing quite frequently so you can have that feedback loop. Now, in my experience, working for like companies where we literally work on, hey, we're going to deliver software every 2 weeks or at the end of every sprint, and we're going to go through a process to do that, versus, you know, working with, you know, other companies where there's a whole bunch of quote unquote checks and balances, and I put those in quotes for a reason, but there's a whole bunch of checks and balances where it takes like a month to deliver something, right? And so your feedback loop to the customer, if you think about a month timeline, is 12 times a year. But anyway, not to get into all those specifics, but to answer your question, right, the feedback loop for an Agile team within the team is really good because it's getting out there to QA really fast with the whole CI/CD pipelines, getting the product fast. And with a good company that's planning, hey, we're going to release every 2 weeks or after every sprint, hey, we're getting into the customer's hands fairly quickly so they can give us feedback on it. But, you know, then other places, process.
Yeah, right. I completely agree, right? Now, I'm going to turn the question kind of in the other direction. At what point do you think deploying is too frequent? And obviously there are some caveats to that, right? Like I imagine that can depend on like what's the business, you know what I'm saying? Like what, depending on different problems, is it a hot fix? You know, like there are obviously, you know, intricacies to that, but just speaking on a general level, like, at what point do you feel like, all right, you know what, like we're releasing like too frequently, or do you feel like that's a thing?
I do think it's a thing, or it can be a thing. Let me say that. I think when you know that you're releasing too frequently is when it becomes disruptive, and not just disruptive to the customer, but disruptive to the team process. Because again, it takes something to deliver software. Yeah. You can have the best automated processes in the world, and I believe you should. This is not an excuse. I hate saying stuff like this, right? Because if you, as soon as you say it, people use that as an excuse. Like, oh, well, you said, you know, it's disruptive to have automated processes. Listen. In an ideal world, everything's automated. You push a button and it goes to production, right? But there's still the effort that needs to be put into that, right? You just can't, you know, again, to your point, not the wild, wild west, right? We just don't throw it out there and let it go. So there, it still takes time. I think, though, when it becomes disrupted to the team, just become disrupted to the customers, that's when we are releasing too frequently.
I think that's a great answer. And I think that can speak to kind of the maturity, right? The maturity of, like, the team, the maturity of your deployment process, right? Okay. Because if you guys can handle that to where you can deploy multiple times a day, and like I said, it's not disruptive, and you're getting value out there, and it's not disrupting the business or anything like that, like, I'm all for it, you know. But I'll give an example of kind of going to what you just said. Years ago, before I got into, like, managing and stuff like that, I was on this team, and my lead, he said, yeah, we want to get to a place where we can deploy up to 10 times a day. And, like, not only was the team not used to that, but beyond that, in my mind, I was like, but why? nobody came to us and said, we need you guys to deploy multiple times a day. Like, I was sitting there like, why? Like, we could easily just, like, deploy whenever we need to. Maybe it's once every 2 weeks, maybe it's once a week, maybe it's twice a day. But why are you specifically trying to meet this specific mark, you know? And I remember he would bring it up like multiple times in different team meetings. And I felt like that was disruptive to the team, because it kind of put us in a point where we were trying to find reasons to say, like, all right, yeah, we deployed, you know?
Yeah. It's funny you say that, right? Because you asked the question, why, right? And I know people, they hate that question, right? Especially, I feel like some people read from, like, the same playbook, because I've heard that before. I've actually had a manager come tell our team that before. It's like, hey, we need to be in a place where we can release 10 times a day. And it's like, where'd you get this from? Like, what why would we, to your point, right? Why would we do this? Side point real quick. I don't know if you remember this guy named Scott at RSI. He was like,
VP.
So he, you know, kind of go back to the whole read from the same playbook, right? And they quote this stuff as if, like, they came up with it, right? I'll never forget. We was in a meeting one day. It was like this in the office or something. And we were all there. We was actually in, like, the conference room or something. He had came down to visit, and he said a quote.
Yeah.
He said, you know, we like to invest in our employees. And somebody came asking the question, well, what if we invest in them and they leave? And he was like, well, I asked him the question back. What if we invest in them? And they stay, or we don't invest in them and they stay. And I'm like, that's a very good statement, right? Because his point was, like, you know, we don't invest in people when they stay. We got terrible people, right? Man, tell me how I saw that quote on LinkedIn, like, 2 weeks later, somebody else has said this, like, it had been posted before and everything. I'm just like, wow, like, you really, like, took that as if, like, you came up with something so insightful, man. But anyway, it reminds me of that story that you just brought up with that whole 10 times a day. Because I've literally heard that exact same statement before and had the same question.
Right.
Why would we do this?
Right. Like, people just, they go find a quote and think it's, like, magical or something. Yeah. Like, come on, man. Like, you have to explain the logic behind that. So, kind of going into, like, when Agile works and giving kind of a success story, I wanted to give an example of a company that did it really well, and it was something that wasn't conventional. So I found that Spotify, they actually had a very interesting model when it came to Agile and how they work together. So if you think about Safe, their structure is kind of similar, but with less process. So I'll kind of go into, like, the different, like, roles that they have. So they had something called a squad, which was basically a scrum team, but they called them squads. And then they would have a tribe, which is basically a collection of squads. And then they would designate a tribe lead. And so if you think about in the context of Safe, like, if you're doing, like, PI planning and you have, like, a scrum of scrums, and maybe you have, like, an elected person that goes to scrums, and they represent kind of like either your team or like your agile release train. Kind of think of that context for like this tribe lead. Then you have a chapter, which is a group of ICs across different teams with similar skill sets to ensure that there are, you know, there are standards in place regarding different parts of the tech stack. Then you have a trio, which is made up of a tribe lead, a product lead, and a design lead, if you know, a design lead is needed. And they basically lead kind of, you know, close collaboration across a tribe. So if you have like initiatives, and I'm sure you've seen this in PI planning, where you have, oh, I have this dependency on this team within my agile release train or something, then you can kind of think of a trio as driving those initiatives and making sure there's like alignment across the tribe. Then you have an alliance, which is made up of multiple trios for collaboration across multiple tribes. So obviously, like, this is like very unconventional from what I'm used to seeing. I'm gonna guess and say you haven't worked in that type of environment, Hollywood, but please correct me if I'm wrong. But when I was reading up on this, it sounds like it worked for them. And that's kind of the point that I want to make, is that Agile looks very differently from team to team, from company to company. But the key point is, like, do what works for you, you know? Like, just going back to what we were saying about deploying. If you're deploying multiple times a day for a reason, not because somebody said deploy 10 times a day, but if you're deploying for a specific reason and it's working and it's not disruptive, like you said, then do that. You know, if you need to deploy a little less often, once a sprint, and that works for you, works for the business, do that. You know, now obviously you have to have boundaries, right? Like, to your point, you don't want to release, you know, so little to the point where like that feedback loop isn't short, you know. But I mean, as long as you're able to adapt, do what works for the team, do what works for the business. And I feel like ultimately, like, at the end of the day, we have all these terms, all these conventions, we have the manifesto, but at the end of the day, that's what I believe Agile is here to do. Ensure that we do what works for the team, what works for the business, we solve problems, and we can adapt.
Yeah, I like that, right? Like, do what works for you. Let me ask you this question, though. How do you know what works for you?
That is a great question. And I think you have to take feedback from both the team as well as from the business side, right? Like, I think you said something in a previous episode that really stuck with me, which is, as an engineering manager, and by the way, I'm not trying to say that engineering managers are solely responsible for making sure Agile works, but you said as a manager, you have to manage up and manage down, right? And so, kind of pulling on that same thing, I think you have to ensure that it's working from different sides, right? So from the team perspective, guys, is this working? You know, do we have too much process, too much bureaucracy? Then you also have to look at it from the business perspective, right? Because it's like, all right, cool. Like, yeah, the team might be happy, but are we just locking ourselves in a building and just saying, leave us alone? Well, that's not going to be productive either, you know? So yeah, we can't run away from the business, you know? And I've actually seen teams like that where they're so defensive, so overprotective, that like they almost run away from the business. And it's like, well, that's not how you should be working. We should really be collaborating with them. But we have to, you know, surface the pain points on both sides and try to come to common ground. You know, I don't think anybody's going to be 100% happy, but I think it's all about finding that harmony.
Yeah, I like that. And I think the meeting, or the thing that Agile facilitates that feedback in, is like the retrospectives, right? I do think the retrospectives have value, not just within the team, but, it, you know, when we talk about SAFe, right? And to those who don't know what SAFe is, I'm assuming, you know, some people do, but SAFe is like taking Agile and deciding to do it for the whole enterprise, right? We'll probably get into why I don't believe Agile works in the first place. But I think the retrospectives are important, because that's how you get your feedback. It's like, hey, did this work? that does not work. Same thing with the business and stuff like that. I think the biggest hindrance, and again, I don't know if we're going to get into this, but the biggest hindrance to Agile is people. You said something in like a few episodes ago, which was something I wholeheartedly agree with, which you have people sit on these calls and don't say anything. Well, if you don't say anything, you brought zero value to the retrospective. Yeah. So that means you brought zero value to the whole Agile process. So that's why the process just... it is going to fail because it just you can't say anything, like nobody can read your mind, right? So the retrospect is important, and like you said, that's to me where you get it, but bro, you gotta speak up though. You gotta talk.
I completely agree. Now I will say that maybe you might have a team that doesn't speak up because maybe they've tried and maybe they got bit. Or I won't say bit, but like they're tired of like nothing happening. I'm not sure. I'm just kind of throwing out an example. But I completely agree. Retros are extremely important. Let me ask you this. This has happened to me twice now as a manager, Hollywood. So in my last manager role, the team had the retro. I had just joined as a manager. This was a brand new team. But these people have been like handpicked from other teams. And I guess there were some frustrations going on with how they felt about the company. And so I didn't join retro because kind of the standing thing was like, oh, you know, psychological safety, which, you know, I agree with. But apparently they actually told the scrum master, no, we want Trevor here because we want him to hear this because we're not happy. And in my new manager role, I heard something similar not too long ago where our Agile coach was like, yeah, they actually want the managers in the retros. And I was like, oh, okay. You know, like I'm all here for it. Like, if you know, like I do believe in supporting the team, you know, and being there. But by the same token, like, where does that land to your point with some people that might kind of clinch up if the manager is there? How do you manage that?
Yeah, so I don't show up to retros, actually. Well, let me take that back. I don't show up to retros within my team, my immediate team. Mm-hmm. But I am in the PI retros, the whole quarter, you know, quarterly PIs. Mm-hmm. If y'all know PIs, program increments, it's pretty much a quarter of a year where we have planning and stuff like that. And after you do planning, you have a retrospective, right? So I join for all those retros. But for the ones within the team, I actually try to avoid, and I try to avoid it for a very specific reason. And that is, I feel like my voice carries a lot of weight. And just by title alone, I think my voice carries weight. So just as a manager being there, hey, my manager's here, to your point, I'm a tense up. Like, I don't really want to say too much, especially if you're like a junior or like that. You start respecting titles just because they're titles. Right. And so I don't like to be there because I want the team to really, truly feel empowered to make change and voice change. And then they'll come to me or some representative. Why it would come to me and say, hey, we want to implement these changes and here's why, we can have a conversation about it. But it's tough, right? Like I've never been asked to be in a retro either. If I'm not there, you know, typically they don't ask me to be there. But the reason why, another reason why my voice carries a lot of weight is you all heard me on this podcast multiple times, right? Like I am very like opinionated, right? And I have a lot of reasons as to why I feel like we should do something. I'm going to speak up. In those meetings, it's very hard for me to kind of sit back and be a fly on the wall. That's kind of not really my personality at work. So I try to join. I want the team to truly feel empowered. But then when we talk about retrospectives at the larger level, that PI level, I'm highly vocal in those meetings. Because again, like you said before, I'm trying to manage up and down. So this is the voice of all the teams. This is the voice of all of leadership if they show up. For us to kind of communicate and iterate on it and make it better and make it smoother. But I'm like you. I typically don't show up if I'm not asked.
Sure. I completely agree. Cool. All right. So we kind of talked about like when Agile succeeds, you know, how it works really well. Now I kind of want to turn the page a little bit and talk about when, where, how it fails. And to your point, I think you said something earlier that is really probably going to highlight a lot of the examples that we cover, but it's really once you get outside of the team, right? That's when the chaos starts, honestly. so I kind of have a couple things here that I kind of want to just hit on. First off, signs of what they call agile theater. So basically, you're putting on as if you're doing agile, but it's really just a show. Like you're just running around in circles. Daily stand-ups that are just status reports to managers. And I'm going to stop here, Hollywood, because you said something before that really resonated with me, and ask you, should managers even be at stand-ups?
I typically, again, don't show up. Because what tends to happen, what I found tends to happen is that when I show up on less mature Scrum teams, if I show up, it tends to become, hey, does anybody have any questions for EB? Right, like that's not what stand-ups for, right? Yeah. I just want to hear what you've been working on, what blockers you have, and then y'all work through any issues that y'all have, you know, in parking lots or whatever you call them, right? So I don't think a manager should be there, and if they are there, they're just truly a fly on the wall. Like, you should really redirect all the questions back to, hey, this is not how stand-up should be to be functioning, but it's natural, right? Because they have questions, and like, well, we'll just ask the manager. That's not healthy, in my
opinion. Yeah, I completely agree. And I also, kind of going back to what you said about empowering the team when it came to retros, like I would agree for stand-ups. Like, I think, especially if you have a tech lead, right? I think what I want to do is see the team move as a cohesive unit, you know? So when you guys have stand-up, y'all have stand-up, you know? Like, don't like you said, I don't want to be in the meeting, like, driving this thing and having, you know, answering everybody's questions and having input and having influence. You guys need to drive this thing, and then you guys come holler at me if you know something is awry, you know. So I completely agree with you on that. In my new role, they actually want managers at stand-ups, and in my mind, that was kind of one of my thoughts. I was like managers, you know, are going to be at stand-ups. That's interesting, because I don't think we should be a critical part of that process.
You know, I think context matters too, right? I think if you only have one team, you being a stand-up isn't too big of a problem. But when you have, when you start pulling multiple teams or larger teams under you, that's when it becomes a problem, because one person can't scale. And so you can't just,
exactly.
you have to find a way to make sure that the team feels empowered to do work without you. Because if not, how are you ever going to go on vacation and not come back to a mess, at least?
Bingo. Bingo. Put it on a shirt. Stamp it. Okay. Next one. Velocity and story points weaponized against developers. Ooh. And yeah, that's a tough one, man. That's a tough one. I don't... Going into story points, I feel like we have really lost sight of what they were even like purposed for. Like basically, and I want to ask you this, Hollywood, like, can you ever tell me a time where you have been in a team where story points did not map to a unit of time? And maybe you have been in a team. I mean, I have, where we actually use them for the actual purpose, but majority of teams I've been involved with, it was always, oh yeah, well, a story point is basically a day, or it's basically an hour, you know, and it's like, all right, well, what are we talking about now?
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. I've always fought back against that. So we've had it come in when people like our agile coaches and stuff like that, when we used to have those, they would come in and they would kind of try to argue that, right? And I would push back like hard on it. So it never actually was a thing with any of my teams, because I would use their own evidence against them, right? Like, I don't know your experience with agile coaches, but my experience has never been good, because they'll come in and I like to talk in specifics. You know me, I want to talk in specifics. I want to talk about general, oh, it's a 1-point story or 3-point story. Like, what does that mean exactly? And so they'll, the example that they use a lot is they love this example. Putting a button on a page, and everybody like putting a button on a page. Just imagine you're putting a button on a page. That's not more than like one story point, right? Sure, right. But out of all the work that we do, when's the last time you only put a button on a page? Let's use a real world example. So anytime we had like these, we had like these workshops, a week workshop. Like I actually was safe certified for a while because we had to go through the workshop and everything. And it was the dumbest thing that I felt like I ever had to go through. Complete waste of time. Because they'll be like, you have any questions? And you know me, I got questions, right? So I ask questions and they'll be like, well, you know, it's not, you know, we don't have to really get into all that. And what's the point of me asking the question? What's the point of asking for all the questions, the listening questions?
Right.
So I would always ask them, say, hey, let's get into specifics. Let's talk about a real user story, not one about creating a button on a page. Like, we're never going to do this. Let's use a real example. Because they're like, well, you got to map QA's velocity into our story points into it. You got to the developer account. It's like, those two things are not the same.
Yeah.
Like, at all. So who wins? They were like, well, the highest number wins. Well, if the highest number wins, QA is probably going to always be the highest number. Right? Like, I don't understand what we're trying to achieve. Anyway, I don't even remember what your question was. I went to a tangent. I apologize. But but typically, I think it was the story points and time. I fight very hard against that. So I've actually, none of my teams have ever done it. And when they try to do it, I push back and say, hey, we don't equate story to time. Like, it's either one or the other, not both.
Yeah. So have you ever, so you guys are using story points?
Yeah.
Yep. Okay. But it's not directly mapped to a unit of time. Let me ask you this. Have you ever worked in an environment where you guys just don't use story points?
No. We've always used story points because we got to put something there, right? Like you got to put a value in the tool. For the level of effort. So we've always used story points. Did we use it correctly? I can't say that we do. I can actually go on a real whole tangent about like story points time, really, really fighting very, very hard not to, right? But I prefer story points because it's not a real unit of measurement in real life, right? Mm-hmm. Like it is what it is.
Right.
And so and I'll just sum it up like this. If you can't give me real requirements or real timelines, it's gonna be very hard for me to like commit to giving you real time and delivering something. Right. So I wouldn't mind using units of time as a measurement for a story if I felt like the requirements were always going to be good and clean and the direction was always going to be good and clean. But in my experience, that's never the case. And so, I'm not willing to give it to you.
That's it. Nope. Not getting it. You're preaching to the choir, right? You're preaching to the choir. I feel like in my experience, I have seen instances where there are good requirements, but the direction changes, right? And so, and I've been in situations where Hollywood, like the direction is like ever changing. Like, so this is kind of me going on a tangent as well. And then we'll kind of pick back up and I'll leave it at this, but I feel like when it comes to Agile, I do think you have to draw a line in the sand at some point because, sure, we're here to adapt. But now, if we're adapting every day, we're never going to get anything done.
Right.
So I have been in those experiences where, like, we have solid requirements for this project. I told you it was going to take X, but then you added in Y, Z, A, B, C while we were trying to focus on this. So guess what? What I told you originally changes. No, non-negotiable. Yeah, it changes.
Everything costs something. Whether you're measuring in story points or you're measuring in time, it's going to cost me effort. Whether that story points or time, it's going to cost me something. So when you try to change the direction, the likelihood of us have already gone in and it's like, oh yeah, we knew this was coming down or we knew this was in the future. We've already kind of estimated out. We likely haven't done that. So if I had let's say I had 5 story points left or I had, I don't know, two or three days. Yeah, I don't know how you do time, right? Like 2 or 3 days left, right? And you come in and say, hey, we got to do this new thing and we got to change direction. Well, this 2 or 3 days left that I had on this was contingent upon me starting now. Now you want me to pivot and I have to understand what you're asking me to do. And then I have to effort. It's not even an equal trade-off. But anyway, it's not a perfect science. I feel like they try to implement science into something that's not a perfect science. It's crazy. Like, it is insane.
You're preaching to the choir. Preaching to the choir, right? Okay, so one thing that we already kind of touched on, but I do have it here, is retro notes that never change anything. So, you know, are there teams where maybe they're coming up with good ideas in retros, but nothing's changing? You know, is it one of those situations where the business has basically committed a land grab, and you are basically at the will of the business, and whatever they say goes? And I feel like that's indicative of, honestly, like, probably either a toxic culture and or bad leadership, because what is going on here? You know, like, now we're just being pulled along, and I feel like we have really lost sight of, like, what problems are we even trying to solve? We're just yes men.
Yeah, preach, right? Like, I think there was a quote that said, trust is hard to earn and easy to lose. And I think that's what happens with the agile process and why it works like it works today. If we have, what's the point of doing retro if you know nothing's going to change?
Right.
And you can't fault them, right? Like, you can't fault them for, like, not believing in the process anymore. I'm like, I'm with you. If nothing's going to change in the retro, why not do it? We shouldn't do something that doesn't matter.
Right. 100%. Okay. So I will kind of bring up this example, and then I'll kind of move on from Agile Theater. But I saw this in, there's a Reddit called Agile, and there was a thread where this user posted, and they said, my team used to work with tasks, and we've since moved over to user stories, and the team doesn't like the user story format because we say, as a blank, I want to ba da 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 da. And I guess the team felt like it was a little more, like, unclear, like the format of it's just confusing, you know, versus, like, with the task, like, they just had the description, they could talk about it, it was just more straightforward. And so the user was trying to get feedback on, like, should you prioritize a user story over a task because of this? And I kind of put this in the section of Agile Theater because I feel like, okay, why are you even using that format to begin with? Why are you saying you must use a user story over a task? You know, I feel like these are signs of, like, why are you doing what you're doing? Are you just doing it because it's agile, because a user story is just what you commonly see, you know? I'm not saying you shouldn't use your user story, but I'm just saying, like, what works for the team, you know? Now, with that being said, you do have to have visibility to some level with the business, right? Like, they need to know, like, what value are we delivering, you know? What are we working on, you know? So I'm not saying, like, we should just create low-level tasks and go put them in a vault somewhere. But by the same token, like, I mean, come on, dude. Like, if the team is saying that the way this is written is more productive for them, write it that way. Like, that's just, you know, like, once again, I feel like this is a sign of Agile Theater, where just because companies use that as a I want to blank, now you feel like you have to follow that.
Yeah. I would just be repeating something I said probably before, which is, if it doesn't make sense, we probably shouldn't do it. If you can't answer the why, let's not do it and move on, right?
Right. Okay, cool. So next, the danger. It's funny how we're kind of already hitting some of this stuff. The danger of cargo culting, following ceremonies without understanding the why. And here I kind of have a question that I wanted to throw your way, Hollywood. If you had control over the methodology a new team would be following for a brand new product, like, this is greenfield, but the business has already kind of attached loose timelines. You know, I don't know if you've ever had that happen. I've seen it where they won't directly say that this is the estimate, but they'll say, yeah, you know, we would like to roll this out by blank. So right there, you've already kind of tied us to a timeline, right? But if you were building out a new team, a brand new product, and they were kind of already starting to tie things to timelines, what methodology would you start out with for that team?
Well, let me say this first. Their timelines wouldn't dictate the methodology that I pick. As a matter of fact, their timelines wouldn't even matter to me.
Yep.
Because I'm being 100% honest, y'all. Their timelines wouldn't matter. Like, if you're saying that, hey, we're going to deliver something in December. It is currently, what, September or something like that? About to be September. Right. And we don't have anything because there's no methodology, right? So that clearly we don't have anything. You pulled that out of somewhere that anybody could have pulled it from, right? You could have got somebody on the street to come with the timeline. Timeline doesn't mean anything. And I wouldn't build my methodology based off of that. Like, I'll go and I'll manage up that timeline. But what I would do is I would stick to something that I feel like that I can understand. I think works well for the teams that I am on. So I actually like Kanban. I'm a real big fan of Kanban, but I do see that there are like kind of gaps with that as far as like, if you do have timelines in a team, is it really going to be tied to timelines? Not the timelines, they just the gate, right? But we are going to be tied to timelines. I'm likely not going to do Kanban. So I'll do Scrum. I'll do 2 week sprints, the normal stuff. I prefer user stories, actually. I don't like the format, like the as this, do this format. I actually like the give and win then format because it's very situational. It's very specific. And then developers can, if they like tasks, they can go and they can build their task off those user stories. But what the user stories gives me from an engineering manager standpoint, I can track velocity of the team. I can track how well we can likely deliver it within the next sprint. If we're behind on something, if we're ahead of something, I can do that a lot better, and I can do it at the task level. Because the task level gets, I can imagine, the task level gets so granular because it's to the developer's level that I still code, right? I don't necessarily want to go and look at all the tasks, right? I need a little bit higher level picture so I can go and manage up. But I got to go look at all these tasks. Like, I'm never going to get to the whole point where we got this timeline that's ridiculous. Yeah. So I would use user stories. I would have the engineers break it down the tasks if they wanted to. I'm not big on enforcing something. Like, my framework is, hey, let's have the user stories. Let's have features that roll that user stories roll up into, so I can track the feature level, right? Epics, that gets into product. I don't really care too much about that. I want the features, right? I can work with features. Yeah. Let product handle features and epic level and stuff like that. But that's what I would implement for any team, regardless of what those timelines were. But I would implement that if we knew that we are always going to be working towards timelines, if that makes sense.
No, I think that's a great answer. I like what you said in the very beginning where you said you're a big proponent for Kanban. So from my perspective, I almost wonder if I would start with Kanban and I would just kind of like work my way up and say, all right, cool. We go through a 2 week increment sprint, right? But I'm not going to call it that, right? But basically what I'm trying to get at is I want to have as little process starting from the beginning, and then we see where are the gaps, and then we work towards like, all right, what truly works? What's the middle ground between the team and the business? So honestly, we probably would end up in some format of Scrum, honestly. To your point, like, man, like, I just love how loose Kanban is. And especially if it's like kind of a brand new thing, like, I just really want us to like, all right, you tied us to the timeline. Everybody just stop, be quiet. You know, like, what problems are we trying to solve? You know, you know, so.
No, I think it's a good approach. Less process in place starting out and then figuring it out. I would say that chaos to normalization, natural normalization. I think it's a good approach.
Right. Cool. All right. Sweet. So another question I have here is Agile just the new way companies say fly the plane while building it? Like, how do you deal with the business constantly trying to change things? And I guess I can probably phrase this question in a more politically correct way. You know, we're talking about managing up, managing down, managing different ways. How do you manage in the direction of the business to help product? Because ultimately, like, I think product is kind of should be more accountable for it. But how do you work with product to help steer the business in the direction that you're delivering value? They have visibility into the value, but they're not telling you like every other day, like, oh, we changed this thing. Go do this. You know, now go do this. Now go do that. Oh, and by the way, are you still committed to that timeline that we talked about before we added in all this scope creep?
Yeah, I use the process against them, right? It's kind of start like weaponizing the process. So if you say that we need to switch, you know, after we've committed to something, right, then something has to leave. Or if it's not, then it's a no. And it's a point blank no, right? And if there is a problem with the no, well, I'm going to lean back on the process. The process has my back. Whether I agree with the process, that's a whole nother thing. But I will use the process to my advantage, right? So if you come in and say, hey, yeah, we mean to do this, but the process says we can't do this unless something has to leave, but we need to deliver everything. Well, the process says, you agile says, we cannot do that. Something has to go. So you have to make the decision. I put the decision back in their hands. Like, you have to make a decision. You have to pick something or nothing is going to happen.
You're preaching to the choir, right? I've done that before as well, and man, like, some of the reactions, man, like, they do not like when you kind of put that foot down. But hey, man, my thing is, like, I don't know what to tell you, you know, like, like you said, this is the process, you know what I'm saying? And then you guys love Scrum, you know, so like, y'all love having that visibility. Well, guess what? This is our capacity.
Exactly. Because honestly, if Scrum or Agile within like the team, I love. It's the scale Agile that I actually dislike. So you all want us to do scale Agile, then we need to do it properly. Don't come in and be like, hey, well, EB, you got to be flexible. No. Y'all not flexible when we say we don't want to do this. So I don't see myself being flexible saying that, hey, we just going to disrupt the team like that and bring something new in.
Yeah, and I feel like when you're dealing with the business and or bad leadership, one thing that I think just really grinds the team's gears is sprint metrics, you know, because now we have all of these things that you're unfortunately, I feel, are weaponized, and the team's constantly, it goes from delivering value to we're just trying to hit these metrics. In my current role, one of the first things that I saw, because I saw like these metrics, I met with the Agile coach, and like some of these metrics are off. One of the first things I noticed is the amount of story points that we pulled into the current sprint. And we had pulled in like 40 something story points, but we had only removed like 8 or something like that. And I'm sitting here, I'm like, well, like, what are we talking about? You know, I would go on to bet though. I would go on to bet. I'm still kind of, you know, getting into the swing of things, but I would bet that was probably not their like doing. Like, I don't believe that they were just sitting there and like, let's just pull that stuff in. You know, like, I would bet that they were strong armed into pulling in additional things, but then they're under the weight of, oh, well, we still have to get everything else done.
And then
the metrics are off, and then people are looking like, well, what's going on? And it's like, I mean, like, like you said, a human can't scale.
You know? And then it comes back to trust, right? Because you talk about these metrics, they want metrics because more than likely teams may not have been delivering when they expected to be delivering, whatever the factors are, because a lot of times it's not the team's fault. It's just a lot of BS that just comes their way. Tracking a developer's metrics is actually fairly difficult. I actually worked at a place where we have like code cutoff dates, right? Let's just say the code cutoff date is today.
Yeah.
And that's depending on when the user story is closed. It has nothing to do with when the code's merged in. So, Trevor, what do you think? So you just, okay, cool. I'll meet code cutoff. Easy. Done.
Right.
No matter. Okay, I push new code in, hey, tomorrow. Like, you're not tracking that, right? Like, it's, so it's, again, just process for sake of process. Metrics, like, oh my gosh. Anyway.
Yeah. Okay, cool. So last one. And I'm gonna kind of switch the tone here. But I thought this was kind of interesting. If Agile is about flexibility, feedback, and responding to change, could the Agile mindset actually apply to DEI initiatives or culture shifts inside organizations? And here I have some examples. So, short iterative improvements instead of large information sessions with an employee resource group, retrospectives regarding culture and inclusion to discuss like what's working, what's not working within the company as far as these initiatives, And then real-time feedback loops when employees raise concerns related to their identity. Do you think we could take some of these principles from Agile and apply them to kind of a DEI initiative within a company?
In the year 2025? No. Probably not. Okay, 26, we'll say 27 year. To 28, to be honest with you. But after that?
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, maybe 2021, 2022, 2023. Maybe it would have been more plausible.
I don't think so. I don't try to be a pessimist either, right? But I'm a realist. I definitely try to be a realist. Yeah. I don't think so. Yeah. Also, too, I think what's really important in order for that to work is you have to have diverse sets in the room in the first place in order for the retrospectives to even matter, right? Because if the only opinion you hear is yours or somebody like you, right? Like, I mean, what value does that bring, right? So it's like if we both did a retrospective on Agile, we mainly agree on most stuff, right? So the only thing that's going to change is the things that favor us. So they take that into, you know, a retrospective for DEI, and it's only a certain group of people in there. But I mean, you're gonna get what you're gonna get.
Yeah, I'll say this. I think it's interesting. I really think it's interesting how much influence politics can have just over like corporate culture. And I, you know, I guess I'm just now really starting to see that. And so to your point, like in the year 2025, I don't think this would ever be something that would be discussed or, you know, put forth that as a proposal. You know, as a matter of fact, I would actually go a step further and say, if a company has employee resource groups, I would question if those are at threat of being dissolved.
Yeah. I know some places that actually did get rid of it. I'll say this. Wow. I was reading this book. I haven't finished it yet, but it's called it's called Barracoon. And it's a book about the a slave from the last slave ship. And there's a quote in there. I don't remember it verbatim, but the quote basically reads as, the one thing that this slave realized was that greed has no color, because this slave was sold from Africa. His own people sold him into slavery, right? And white America bought him in slavery. Just kind of listening to those dynamics, it was like that's true. So we mentioned politics. It's like it really comes down to like greed, in my opinion. It kind of comes back to the money. You can trace it back to the money. Like, I don't think there's any other reason for any company to really move away from DEI initiatives other than money.
Yeah. It's unfortunate. It's unfortunate, man. Year 2025. Okay, cool. So, we can wrap up, and I want to wrap up with some agile myths that I want to kind of just, you know, blow those up real quick. And then we'll head out with our final thoughts. So, agile myths. Number one, agile equals no documentation. The reality is that while agile does value working software over comprehensive documentation, you still need to document what's necessary, right? Obviously, by no means am I sitting here and saying that, just document, don't deliver value. But I mean, Hollywood, you know, we both have a background in coding. Documentation is very, very helpful. Next one, agile is faster. That's a good one. So the reality is agile is not about going faster. It's about delivering value sooner and adjusting as you go. Sometimes it even feels slower, especially if you're constantly adjusting. So Hollywood, going back to the conversation we had about if things are changing every day, then, I mean, what are we doing? I think I heard a quote a while back, which was like, if everything is the priority, then nothing is a priority. Oh. Because what are we going to get done if every day is something different? Now we're just chasing our tails.
What's higher than high?
Right. And everything's high. Okay, cool. Next one. Agile doesn't work for big organizations. The reality is it's harder, but not impossible. The real barrier is usually culture, leadership, not size. And then the last one, Agile is a silver bullet. And I think this is something we really, really need to stress on with like the business, with various industries that do quote Agile. Like, Agile is not a silver bullet. It can't fix poor leadership, lack of vision, or toxic culture. It just exposes them faster. Also, Agile should be what works for the team and their stakeholders, not a strict methodology. So those are the Agile myths I wanted to blow up. And kind of the last question, Hollywood, is if you had to rank methodologies from least favorite to most favorite, which would you choose? And I think I know what that order would be based on what you said, but how would you rank those?
Yeah, least favorite, I would say Scrum, and then most favorite is Kanban.
Really? So you would put, well, where would you put Safe in that?
I don't like Safe. if we must consider Safe, it would definitely be on the low end. The problem I have with Safe is the goal of Safe is to scale Agile to the enterprise. There are too many functions in an enterprise organization that functions differently to stuff them all into one methodology. Like that is impossible. Yeah. So now the needs of one organization will naturally trickle down into everybody. The biggest offender I've seen of this is finance. Because finance says, oh, some things fall into this bucket and some things fall into that bucket. And now you have to manage that. And I'm like, I do not care. My job at the end of the day is to build and deliver software. Whatever bucket y'all find a way to pull that money from, that has nothing to do with me.
I completely agree. I'm sure you guys have done they don't have a name for it. Well, they didn't have a name for it when I was doing it, but it was basically like annual or yearly planning, where like months before the year starts, by the way, which you don't even have like solid requirements at this point, you're basically being asked, to your point, to kind of categorize things into these financial buckets that will be used in the following year. And you're sitting here like, I don't know. You guys are saying a lot of things I don't understand. And guess what? My product counterparts don't even know yet what it is we're going to be doing. So I don't have a good answer.
No, you just end up making it up. You just literally end up making it up. Hey,
that is literally what happens, Hollywood. Like, senior leadership comes down, guys, we have to do this. Okay.
What do you want me to put into this Excel cell? I will put whatever you ask me to put in here, because I don't know. I truly don't know.
Right. I completely agree. So I agree with the same ranking you have. I will put Safe at the bottom. I don't like it. I think it's a waste of time. PI planning takes way too long. And then I will put Kanban as most favorite. So yeah. So that's it. Code Switch Podcast. Thank you guys for listening in. Until next time.
Appreciate it, y'all. Y'all have a good one.
I've seen the powerful fall when the people work together as one. I need you to live or let die. Hold your head high. I'm by your side till it's one. Together we can hold.